From the hills of central New York in the heart of the Finger Lakes, this is Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi. My guest on this episode of Frankly Speaking is Professor Susanna Mila Lewis, who leads the turfgrass breeding program at North Carolina State University. Dr. Mila Lewis is a native Peruvian and at the forefront of developing improved turfgrass varieties, particularly focusing on zoysia grass, St. Augustine grass, and centipede grass cultivars that offer better cold tolerance, disease resistance, and overall performance for the transition zone. Her program's work combines traditional breeding methods with cutting-edge molecular techniques to create the next generation of turf grasses that help superintendents deliver better playing surfaces while reducing inputs. Her collaborations with turf grass breeders across the country are changing the way we develop the next generation of turf grass cultivars. Before we get to my conversation with Dr. Mila Lewis, I want to tell you about DryJack Services. Years ago, I started seeing this tool used and immediately felt like this was the right balance of the concept of water injection cultivation, but injecting sand with minimal disruption. If your course needs some soil amending and could use a little less disruption, then DryJack Services are for you. Learn more about the tailored services DryJack can provide by contacting your DryJack rep or visiting dryjack.com. Welcome to Frankly Speaking, Dr. Susanna Mila Lewis. It is so nice of you to take the time to join me. I know you're really busy, even though the wintertime we slow down a little bit. I'm sure you've got hundreds of thousands of little pots of grass in the greenhouse that you're looking at all the time. Is that pretty much how it goes for you these days in the greenhouse, looking at lots of plugs?
Well, actually, you know, winter is funny because for most people who work in agriculture, you think that summer is the busiest time and then winter you're just kind of sitting at your desk doing nothing, right? But in plant breeding, actually, we do something year-round, right? Like usually this is the time of the year where we're making crosses, we are harvesting seeds from crosses, we're germinating plants. You're right, absolutely right. There's thousands of little plants growing in the greenhouse right now that are getting ready for planting this spring.
So, this is a very niche area of breeding, not one that you'd think someone from Peru and your background would get interested in. I've not been to Peru, but like many South American countries, I don't probably think golf is a big thing. Certainly, football is a big deal down there for sure. But you grew up in Lima, so are you a city kid like me? You grew up among the cement?
I am a city kid. Lima is actually a huge city. Yeah. I think when I was a kid, it had about 8 million people. I think it's now close to 12 million or something like that. So I am definitely a big city kid. But my dad was a farm boy. And, you know, so I grew up listening about his stories about being a farm boy in Central America. He was from El Salvador. And I guess that's a little bit what got me interested in agriculture.
Was having those conversations with your dad.
Yeah, you know, like I was not a stranger to listening about life in, you know, rural areas, right? And he talked a lot. I mean, like for us kids, the weekend activity very commonly was visiting a nursery where my dad would just load the car with plants and bring them to the garden.
Okay, so you had a little green space, and I wasn't a gardener as a kid, but as a kid, I cut grass. I mean, in the New York metropolitan area, we just put a lawnmower in the walked around and cut people's grass. That was my connection. You know, you gardened with your dad, and so I understand then your brothers and other family members were also interested in science. So it wasn't that he was just a gardener. It seemed like there was a lot of science talk going around the house.
You know, it's kind of funny because my dad was actually, I mean, he had a green thumb, but he was a lawyer by profession. He was a trained lawyer, and he quit law the first day that he went to a trial and had to defend somebody. That was the only day in his life that he actually, you know, was a lawyer. After that, he quit, and he actually dedicated his life to literature. My dad started a publishing company in Peru in the 70s. And, you know, a little known fact, he was one of the first people to actually publish Mario Vargas Llosa, who is one of the most famous writers from Peru.
Yes, okay.
And he started literature, then moved to history. So, like, we were literature kids. As a kid, I made little pocket money by helping my dad edit books, funny enough. But you're correct. My eldest brothers, they both went into science. My eldest brother is a doctor, actually. actually, and the second went into biological sciences and ended up being a biochemist and working in pharma. And he left for the US to do graduate school when I was 12. And, you know, that's probably one of the biggest influences in my life, because even when I was 12 and I had no idea what I was going to do as a career, I knew that I wanted to pursue graduate studies and I was going to come to the US to do that.
And so what was that pathway? And what point did you sort of say, okay, I'm leaving Peru and I'm going to be gone for a while? Or was your intention to go study and then return?
My original intention was to go study and return, but I finished high school and I knew I wanted to work in plants. I majored in biological sciences because I wasn't sure yet, like, what exactly with plants. I finished my degree in Peru. Usually you get a bachelor's in 5 years, but I did it in four, and then spent that last year working at the International Potato Center, which is located in Lima. And, you know, I remember my senior year in college, I read this newspaper article that talked about plant breeding, how plant breeders develop improved plants. And they, in a way, you know, their contribution to the world is developing crops that have better yields or more nutritional value or that use less water. And it was kind of one of these aha moments, you know, random newspaper article that tells me, this is it. This is what I want to do with my life. So I did an internship at the International Potato Center as a way of getting a little bit of research experience, but more importantly, trying to get recommendation letters, right? Because a kid coming from Peru, studying in a university with a name that nobody can pronounce in the US, it was like, how am I going to get accepted in grad school? So I figured, you know, hey, the International Potato Center has worldwide reputation, right? If I can work there, I can have that in my CV and recommendation letters from there, maybe I have a chance to get accepted in grad school in the US. And, you know, obviously it worked, right? Like I applied to NC State University to do a master's. I applied to a couple of other schools, but I ended up coming here. I got lucky enough to get an assistantship to come here.
Okay, so listen, before we get into your graduate work, I've gotten to chat with a lot of breeders over the years, right? I've been doing the podcast for 11 years, and I think I've talked to 10 breeders over the years. And one of the things that's pretty consistent among you, Susanna, is you're very meticulous people, right? You don't go into plant breeding if you like a lot of excitement on a daily basis, because you have to be methodically looking for the finest details on individual plants and plant lots of them and put them in lots of places and take lots of data. You know what I mean? And measure leaf architecture. Yeah. This is not for the faint of heart. This is what I call sort of the most meticulous kind of science we do, I think, in biological sciences anyway. Not so much the quantitative end, but the observational end. You know what I mean, Susanna? That there's an enormous amount of observation you have to do. That was appealing to you? I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, I want to be a breeder and change the world and invent a plant. It's another thing to plant 10,000 pots. You know what I mean? So how did you reconcile that? Was that really something that aligned as well once you started doing it?
You know, when I interview new students, you know, when I talk to undergrads thinking about a career in plant breeding, I always say that the thing that appeals to me the most about plant breeding is how diverse it is. I'm a little bit ADD, and plant breeding is perfect for me in that way, because not 2 days are alike. Some days you're in the greenhouse, you can be in a grow chamber, you can be in front of a computer analyzing data, you can be in the field, you can be talking to a farmer, you can give you a presentation. It's just like there's so many different aspects to what we do. And you're right, sometimes you're measuring a leaf, right? And sometimes you're looking at a piece of, I don't know, callus tissue under the microscope. And sometimes you're on a farm looking at a field that might be 200 acres of a particular culture. It's just so incredibly diverse. And we integrate so many different areas of science, right? So as a plant breeder, like you're evaluating, you're looking at physiological traits, you're looking at pest resistance. So you need to know a little bit about entomology, a little bit about plant pathology, genetics, genomics. I mean, it's just like so many different aspects that go into developing a culture. And then there's the business side of it. There's like the patenting and the marketing and all these other components that come in with releasing a culture. So to me, that's the biggest appeal of plant breeding. How is the integration of so many different areas?
So, by the way, thank you for that answer. That's a brilliant answer that I often hear. really good breeding programs are highly integrated with everybody else on the team when you mm-hmm. need that expertise. And you need to be able to speak many languages, right, when you're a plant breeder. But that's within a commodity, right? It yes. must be that the skills in plant breeding are relatively easily transferable, because everything you just described there, well, first you learned it in tobacco.
Yes.
And then you learned it in peanut, right?
Yes.
And so why is it that you guys can seem to wander in through different sort of plant systems? And I'm assuming almost every Kevin Kenworthy, everybody that I've chatted with over the years, Brian Schwartz, all of them are multiple trained in different places, right? So mm-hmm. what is it about the way you guys are trained that allows you to navigate between commodities?
I think ultimately what matters, regardless of the species, is the breeding pipeline, right? Mm. Knowing that you need to evaluate a bunch of lines to determine which ones are the best ones for a particular trait, and then you cross them, and then you generate these thousands of new hybrids, and how are you going to look at these hybrids so you can separate the best from the worst? Mm. And how do you advance the best ones, and what do you do with those best ones? And how do you keep those evaluations, and you, what are the traits that you look at to ultimately produce a commercial product, right? That thing that we call the breeding pipeline that goes from the design of I want to incorporate this trait mm-hmm. into a new cultivar, into the actual process of, you know, like funneling, narrowing down and down and down until mm-hmm. you get the one individual that you want to commercialize. You know, the details of the pipeline are different from one species to another mm-hmm. because obviously, you know, you have like some that are cross-pollinated, right. Other that are selfed, right? Like there's going to be details that change. What are the commercial traits of interest? I mean, obviously, if you're working in wheat, who cares about sod strength, right?
Right?
I mean, I'm being silly.
Right.
Or if you're working in turf, you don't yeah. care about the diameter of the cookie, which
that's
is something
right.
that is important with wheat. But, you know, that ability to set up, to look at something with, this is what I'm going to start and mm-hmm. this is how I'm going to establish my pipeline to ultimately make it to a commercial product, that is common to all species, right? And in a way, like the cross training gives you the ability to maybe think outside the box a little mm-hmm. bit, right? Like mm-hmm. I have been applied certain things that I learned from peanuts, mm-hmm. as funny as that sounds,
yeah.
you know, that helped me set up my program in a particular way.
Mm. So how then did you make the transition from graduate school into this role at NC State? Was there a postdoc in between, or were you able to finish up and then immediately move to the turfgrass faculty? You applied for the position. Gosh, how long have you been there? 15, 16 years?
Am I going to age myself?
No, that's right.
That
oh, no. I forgot. You just got there the other day.
No, I got to NC State in 96. That's
oh,
how old I am, Frank.
Yeah, well, I got another 10 years on you, so you don't worry.
I feel like a spring chicken. So you know that meme in the internet that says, you know, how you think your career is going to be, and it's a straight line, and how
yeah.
your career actually is, and there's like a lots of up and downs.
Yeah.
I'm the poster child for that.
Yeah.
I did my master's in tobacco because that's the assistantship that was offered to me, and I took it, right? And mm-hmm. then I switched to peanuts because peanuts is an important crop in Peru. So I was like, you know, maybe this is going to give me the chance to come back. I finished my PhD, and then I did a postdoc for about a year working in both tobacco and peanuts. And then I was hired by the peanut program as a research scientist. So I was on a non-tenure track position
okay.
for about 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the turfgrass breeding program position opened at NC State. And I remember, you know, like I knew it was open, but I didn't even think about applying because it's like, I don't know anything about turf, right? And the chair of the committee came to me and he's like, you need to apply for this job. And I was like, Paul, are you crazy? I mean, like, I don't know anything about turf. And he's like, no, you don't understand. Like, you know the breeding pipeline,
yeah, yeah.
you know, you just need to learn about the species. You can apply the way you think about different things to mm. turfgrass. And I was mm. like, really? My husband was an assistant professor at the time.
Ah.
I had my first daughter was a year and a half old.
Okay.
So I remember, you know, that night I came home and we sat down at the dinner table and I'm like, can we have two assistant professors in one family?
Untenured, right? Both of you pursuing tenure at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
With a newborn.
Like, with a toddler. I mean, like a, you know, terrible twos is coming around the corner. I was like, can we do that? And Hansel was like, well, you know what? I'm going up for tenure next year. So in reality, it's not like we're going to be seeking tenure at the same time, right? Like you'll be seeking tenure and I'll already have tenure. So I think we should just go ahead and do it. And I was like, okay. So once I made the decision that I was going to apply, I started learning as much as possible, right? Like I talked to anybody who would talk to me. And I really mean that. I went to visit, you know, a golf course superintendent. I went to talk to different sod growers. I talked to extension specialists. I talked to faculty here. I called faculty in other universities. I talked to breeders in the private sector. Because one of the things was, you know, yes, of course, applying for the job and getting the job. But then it was also like, okay, if I'm going to set up a new breeding program in turf in the US, how am I going to set it up so I can be successful, right? Like there's these like really long standing, magnificent programs, right? Like Rutgers, University of Georgia, University of Florida, Texas A&M. I mean, you have these amazing breeding programs that have been going at this for decades. And here comes a new kid, right? that wants to start a breeding program. Like, how am I going to do this? So talking to all these people, it wasn't just about learning about turf, right? It was also trying to understand where were the empty niches, right? Yeah. Like where were the cracks in between programs where I could start working and make a difference in covering things that maybe other people were not covering. And being in the transition zone was kind of like very key in that, right? Like being one of the few programs in the transition zone where heat tolerance and cold tolerance are so critical for specific species.
Exactly right.
That's kind of where I decided to set my tent, let's say.
Yeah, and I'm very glad you did. And you did an absolutely perfect job of bringing us to our first break. I'm with Dr. Susanna Mia-Lewis from NC State University. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back. As we've been discussing, it's vital to invest in research for developing improved turf grass varieties. It's also important for nutrient management programs. The Plant Food Company's line of products, from nutrients and biostimulants to wetting agents and pigments, are backed by science and the professionals to service your needs. Contact your plant food rep or visit plantfoodco.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Dr. Susanna Mia-Lewis at NC State University. And as we wrapped up before, Susanna, you mentioned the cracks and the places where the long-time breeding programs maybe weren't focusing. And one of the things I find fascinating, I was so glad you mentioned being in the transition zone. I had the pleasure of interviewing Melody Frazier. And you breeders are like pathologists, you know. You just want to torture these plants until you can find one that'll survive. And she said, I just love the drama of killing all these plants, you know, the watching them fail, in her case, to gray leaf spot. So how did you determine, with the many things that were available, after you got the job, now you're responsible for setting something up? How did you decide the early direction and how has that evolved over time? Let's start with some of those early years.
So being a transition zone breeder, the general idea was improve cold tolerance in warm season grasses and improve heat and drought tolerance in cool season grasses. But that was kind of it, right? Like from there, I had really had to define specific goals. You know, back then, I mean, that was 2009 when I started the job. Back then, if you drove around Raleigh, you know, Wake County in general, there was a lot of tall fescue, right? Like most of the lawns were tall fescue. So there was this big expectation that I was going to be a tall fescue breeder. You know, of course, the challenge of that was how many tall fescue breeders are out there, right? It's like, well, how are you going to make a niche when there's already so many programs working on that species? But then the other little, you know, piece of the puzzle was, I remember somebody, I cannot even remember who it was, but there was a guest speaker that came to give a seminar in the department. I cannot even tell you what the topic was, what this person talked about. I don't remember anything else. But I remember that he showed this one slide that shows the change in number of days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit going from the last 50 years, right? Like it shows this comparison of two graphs in the US, and it's the last 50 years against 2050 to 2099.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get what, 60 more days? Is it right? Roughly 60 more days of 90 degrees?
Right, it's going to be a lot hotter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, if you look at drought, right, like, the prevalence of droughts is increasing. Mm. So I was like, okay, so does it really make sense, right? Like, if you pull the crystal ball and look into the future, are we really going to be growing as much tall fescue as we are now?
Now, should we? And this is the bigger question.
Right.
Should
and
we? Because should you're going to use a lot of water, right?
Right. So I was like, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think this is a good idea. Breeding is a really long process, right? Like it takes you, if you're lucky in the first go around, it takes you about 12 years to release a new cultivar. So the crosses that you're starting now need to address the needs 15 years from now, right? So am I going to be working only in tall fescue? I don't think so. And based on that, I decided that the program actually, yes, we're going to keep some fescue on the side, but we're going to emphasize on warm season grasses instead. And, you know, one of the things is like, yes, global warming is increasing temperatures, right? Like we know we're hotter now. And one of the things, you know, that sometimes people ask you, well, if we're going to be hotter, why do you need increased cold tolerance? Well, the winters have gotten hotter, yes, but they also have gotten way more erratic.
That's right.
Right? In North Carolina, you can have these weeks where it might be 32 degrees on a Monday, and maybe by Friday, you have these 70. I mean, you might be at 60 or 70. I mean, it's kind of crazy how erratic our winters can be, right? And the problem with warm season grasses is that if they get hot, they deacclimate. And then if it freezes after, that's when you get a lot of winter kill. So cold tolerance continues to be important. So, you know, based on that, I decided I was going to work on warm season grasses and then trying to find, you know, like the traits specifically that maybe other programs weren't addressing as much. So for us, you know, cold tolerance in San Augustine grass was, for example, a big one. Sonog is a good grass here because of the prevalence of pine trees everywhere. So a lot of lawns have pine trees, right? Which means shade, lots of shade. So Sonog would be good for that, but it needs more cold tolerance. So that was a big one to work on. Mm. Soja grass is kind of like everybody's favorite child, right? And I decided to focus more, not on the super beautiful, perfect soja grasses, but try to develop soja grasses that would be like really low input. Mm. So early on, we started a project with the Department of Transportation looking at soja grasses for roadsides, which might seem kind of crazy.
It doesn't seem crazy to me because when I look at every turf grass industry survey ever done in the United States by state, the biggest turf grass manager in every state is the DOT.
Right.
Nobody plants more grass and cuts more grass than the people by the side of the road. I mean, it's really, I always thought, a tragedy we don't have these programs. I tell you, Susanna, I grew up, I went to graduate school at the University of Rhode Island. A guy named Bob Wakefield and Carl Sawyer did hundreds of thousands of dollars of roadside turf grass research. I used to regularly talk to Art Gover at Penn State University on roadside turf. I think Eric Watkins still does roadside turf. For everybody listening in the golf world, you know, we think golf's really important, but, you know, the amount of grass that DOTs plant, so is that a more zoysia environment or a more St. Augustine environment when you do DOT work?
It's more of a soja environment. So they're interested in the low mow aspect of soja grass, right? Like, it's funny because, like, when you say soja grass in roadsides, people look at you like, what? And then you explain a lot of the roadsides in North Carolina are tall fescue. And having fescue means about 6 to 7 mowing cycles per year. And each mowing cycle is $1 million. So you're talking about quite a hefty budget, right? And they're thinking, I mean, what they're looking at is if they've switched to soja, you're looking at 3 to 4 mowing cycles per year. So you're talking about 50% of your budget going down just by switching from one to the other.
Huh. And is this the origin of Lobo?
Actually, yes. Ah. It's funny because that's where Lobo comes from. It was initially tested as a roadside grass. And I guess in a way, I got really, really lucky. I got, you know, my lucky break in that as we started evaluating more and more and putting it into more trials, we realized it's really good for low input because it retains color really well. Mm. You know, like that could be drought, it could be cold, but it's really good at color retention. Mm. You know, kind of like an offshoot, right? Like once we started growing, expanding material to commercial commercialize it, we realize, well, dang, if you actually manage it well and give it some love and care, it looks really, really gorgeous. So it's a little bit of a unicorn, and it does well under very low inputs, but it will look really, really good under normal management.
It's very interesting, right? This is sort of the epitome and the goal in many ways, right, of every breeding program is to develop varieties. But one of the things that I've really been pleased to see with the SCRI grants, the Specialty Crop Research Initiatives, this is sort of the federal government's funding of various commodities that are more specialty, and turf grass over the last bunch of years has been recognized for that. That seems to be one you guys are focusing on drought tolerance more. But also, what are you guys doing, right? Each of you, Kevin and at Florida and Brian at Georgia and you there, Ambika at Texas, like you guys were mentioning, when you collaborate like that, what does that collaboration look like among each of your programs when you're all sort of also developing varieties? Do you just allot the species? Okay, you're doing the drought work on these species. You're doing the drought work on these species. What does that collaboration look like, Susana?
It's been a beautiful collaboration. It started in 2010. Ambika was the lead of that first grant. And then, you know, we passed the baton around. Kevin was next. And I've been lucky to have the third one. It's really nice because we have been able to demonstrate the power of synergizing people's resources. So the way it works is, you know, there's four different species, right? Like we were in paspalum, soja grass, Bermuda grass, and St. Augustine grass. And each breeder enters a certain number of lines. It could be one species, three species, four. I mean, whatever you are working with, you know, we have breeders that only work in one of the species. That's all they enter. And there's breeders that work in three, and you divide the number of lines among the different species. And then we plant those in nurseries at each one of our locations. So, you know, all together, we were able to have like 8 testing locations across the southern U.S. So like from North Carolina all the way down to Florida, and then across Georgia, Oklahoma, Texas, and then University of California, Riverside was added in the last iteration of the grant. So, you know, you have this incredible number of testing environments with very different environmental conditions. So, in a way, you can develop cultivars that have this really wide adaptation, or you can find out maybe that there's a cultivar that doesn't work in the transition zone, or a line, excuse me, that doesn't work in the transition zone because it doesn't have good cold tolerance, but it looks gorgeous in Texas and Florida, right? So, in a way, it allows you as a breeder to expose your materials to environments that you wouldn't have been able to do just in your region.
It's very interesting, right? We think about drought here, particularly you in the Southeast, right? We we think about drought to a certain extent as episodic, right? I mean, there's always climate change is bringing signals like you described, you know, the ups and downs of the winter. It's also bringing intense rainfall and then long periods of dry weather, right? So it makes sense to use warm season grasses for that, you know, because, you know, they're warm season, they're going to use less water. But one of the things I've been fascinated with traveling to the arid part of the United States, where I think we need more effort down where Riverside is, right, in Vegas and Arizona and New Mexico. Drought over there is different than drought as you guys experience it in the Southeast, right? Having a grass in an arid environment. And I'm wondering, when you say wide adaptation, are there some that work well in those conditions, or have we not tested them enough to really know? Because I know, you know, there's some chatter about maybe zoysias might be good for the desert Southwest. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about bringing some of the thinking from the Southeast to the Southwest.
Yes, actually, you know, like that was a nice thing of going to Riverside. Drought is different there. You're right. I mean, it's just an arid environment, right? So it's not like in the South where maybe it stops raining for a month and then it's humid, you know, as usual. There is kind of like always dry, right? And you have to have irrigation. In an ideal world, you want a cultivar that is so drought tolerant that you never water it, right? That would be perfect. But there's also a reality of saving water, right? Like a cultivar that uses half the water. If you're going to save 40% water because you're planting a soja grass instead of a atoll fescue. Hmm. That's already great sustainability. That's great practices, right? It's a good thing. It's a good step forward to increasing the sustainability of our industry. Hmm. That has been part of the beauty of testing things out west. I agree with you 100%. We need to increase our ability to test things in Arizona, for example. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons we released Lobo. Also, we tested it as part of a project with USGA that Aaron Patton at Purdue and Brian Schwartz at University of Georgia are part of. Mm. We were able to test materials in Arizona and in California. And we found that Lobo retained color really well in Arizona. And again, this is not just cutting the water off and never ever watering them, because obviously in such an arid climate, nothing will survive without some irrigation. Mm-hmm. So you kind of like adjusting the way you evaluate things and kind of reduce irrigation versus zero irrigation.
As I think back to some of the early things we were talking about where we mentioned St. Augustine grass and centipede mm-hmm. grass, those are not things you hear about relative to golf courses maybe or even sports mm-hmm. fields. But when you think about the amount of managed St. Augustine grass on lawns, it really dwarfs other types yes. of turf grasses. And I'm not talking roadside stuff now. I'm talking lawns.
Right.
And, you know, the golf guys, sports guys, everybody likes to point their finger at, oh, yeah, it's not us, it's the lawn people. But then, you know, we have to have scientists like you, Susanna, working on these lawn grasses so that they can be lower input. How are we doing with St. Augustine grass, making it lower input? Obviously, it'll do well in shaded environments, right? But I'm wondering mm-hmm. how, you know, it seems to me like uses a lot of water, likes to be fertilized a lot. It looks like the perfect grass for the professional lawn care industry that needs to be, you know, sprayed, watered, fed, mowed. You know what I mean? And
yes.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are in working on St. Augustine grass, knowing it's really important from a lawn perspective, and also know that it is an industry that relies on sort of putting stuff on it.
When I have to give industry talks, right, like last year, for example, I talk at the Green Industry Show here in North Carolina, I always tell people, repeat after me, there is no perfect turf grass species, right? There is a perfect turf grass species for the situation that you have, which is very different, right? Mm-hmm. It's funny how when you become a turf grass breeder, I think that Kevin Kingworthy made that joke that how do you recognize a group of breeders because they're looking down as they walk? You see these funny things, right? Like somebody who has Bermuda grass and they're an oak tree and you're like, why would you do that, right? Or mm-hmm. centipede grass and it looks yellow because they're over-fertilizing it. Or, you know, somebody that is running the sprinklers and it rained yesterday. Mm-hmm. You see all these things out there in the world when you realize, okay, that's not a bad species. It's just in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. So you might want to save a lot of water and plant Bermuda grass. But if you have a really shady lawn, you're not going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. You're better off with St. Augustine grass if you're in the South, right? Mm-hmm. Like it used to be where you could only put fescue and use more water.
Right.
St. Augustine grass uses less water than fescue. Okay. So you're better off with a warm season than a cool season right. if you're in the South.
And but then the problem becomes we don't have the cold tolerance we want in something
right.
like St. Augustine grass, right?
Right. So those are the things that we work with, right? Like, is St. Augustine going to beat Bermuda grass in drought tolerance? No, not really. If mm-hmm. you're looking at it as a species, mm-hmm. right, overall, mm-hmm. not really specific cultivars, but just in general, are you going to have something as drought tolerant as a Bermuda grass? No, no way. You know, I mean, it's just the innate biology of the species, right? But can you develop, I mean, is there enough genetic variation within St. Augustine grass where you have some accessions that are more drought tolerant than other? Mm-hmm. You bet. Right? Mm-hmm. So we just keep working. And Ambika Chandra at Texas A&M, and she's developed some really great St. Augustine grasses with really good drought tolerance, mm. right? Part of the SCRI project has allowed us to do that, to test our grasses. Because also, like, in your location, you maybe get, like, two drought periods, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But working in collaboration with these other people, if I add my drought data during the 2 months that I had drought with mm-hmm. Kevin's drought data in Florida, that would happen maybe during March, and maybe Ambika had a drought period. So now you have all these different data sets for drought when you could have only one, right? So that has allowed, I mean, Kevin also has some great lands with good drought tolerance. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, you know, like if you talk about soja grass, I mean, I hear people saying, oh, soja is never going to be as drought tolerant as Bermuda grass. Well, you know, overall, in general, yes, you're right. But if you're going to look at the combination of cold tolerance, drought tolerance, and shade tolerance, you know, I always say soja is not the best at anything, but it's the second at everything. So if you want a cross, you know, who's going to be your horse in the race? Yeah. I'll take soja any day.
That's right. And this is Dr. Susanna Mila Lewis. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We're selling soja grasses here on Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back. Spray technology is advancing rapidly, and keeping abreast of the best options for your product applications are key. When I have a question, I reach out to the spray tech professionals at Frost Spray Technology. Get an expert on your team by contacting Frost Spray Technology at frostserve.com. That's Frost, S-E-R-V.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Dr. Susanna Mila Lewis. Susanna, one of the things I've been impressed about already, and you know, for those of you listening, we're going to be doing this live on stage in San Diego in a few weeks when we do a live taping of the podcast. But one of the things I can tell from your preparation for the job and the way you approach your work and the way certainly you were trained is you have a real knack for communicating. You are definitely able to sort of talk clearly about very complex topics, right? Breeding is an enormously complex area. And, you know, you have to deal with, as I mentioned earlier, lawn care professionals, the DOT, right? And one of those groups that you guys deal with in the South that's a little bit different than up here, and I don't deal with a lot of too many sod growers in New York State. We only have a handful. It's a fairly large business in North Carolina. And warm season sod business is different because there's no seed, right? Mm-hmm. That vegetative production adds a level of complexity, right, of assurance. Yeah, we label seed, right? And we say it's gold standard and we test for sort of weed seeds and inert stuff. You know what I mean. But when it comes to warm season grasses, there's a real purity. Mm-hmm. And there's also licensing and marketing that works with sod growers, right? You know, you mentioned that pipeline of material that you learned from tobacco and peanut. And now, of course, you've developed exceptionally well in turf grass. Talk to us a little bit. It takes a long time to do it. But then you've got to work with the sod growers at the end. See if we can give the listeners a behind-the-scenes look of, you know, what it's like working and determining how you're going to ultimately produce it and get it into the field.
That's a great question. You know, initially when I set up the breeding pipeline for the program, so we test things in nurseries for 3 years, and we select the best, and then we move them to replicated trials across locations, right? And then you have like your best five or something like that. And it's like, okay, so what's next? I mean, the good thing is having a good relationship with sod growers, because that's your next step. So the last piece in a way of our breeding pipeline is what we call on-farm trials, where we grab the very best lines right after 7 years of testing. Like you're looking at your very best. Like if you started with 1,000 and you're looking at the best five, let's say, we put them on-farm trials. As the name indicates, those are trials that go on sod farms. We have developed, you know, through the years, you develop this wonderful relationship with growers. I go to their meeting every year in January and present from the Breeders' Corner report. That's what it's called. Very boring. But I talk to them, you know, I tell them what I'm working on, what are things that are coming down the pipeline. And, you know, you meet people, you keep seeing the same people. They come to field day, they get interested in the lines. And they have been incredibly generous, you know, to be willing to grow these on-farm trials. So we plant them on their farms. Of course, you try to have them at different locations, kind of to, you know, to represent the environments in North Carolina. Ideally, you want to have one in the mountains, maybe one in the sand hills that where you can test for drought tolerance, one out in the coast so you can get, you know, a heavier pest pressure. And you evaluate them for about, you know, 2 years. And it's, I cannot emphasize how wonderful and useful these are because they're free, for one thing, right? Like they are incredibly generous to just host them and maintain them, not charge you a penny for them, which is absolutely incredible to me. And then the other thing is like you get other pests, right? Like I will never get the chinch bug epidemics, for example, in St. Augustine grass here that I can have at the coast. Mm-hmm. I can get nematodes at Sandhill. So there's these other pests or particular stresses that you're able to expose your best lines to, mm-hmm. so you can have a better idea of, there's no surprises, let's put it that way, right?
So they're partners, right? I mean, when you develop these, it sounds like that's a partnership. But then ultimately, does everybody get to sell it, or does it then become an exclusive thing?
It depends. I mean, there's certain agreements in place where, you know, like there might be a group of specific farmers that get to grow them, and you might have other things where, you know, you release the cultivar and they have the opportunity to license it. I mean, it really depends. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right in the sense that it's a partnership, because also the third thing that you get from growing on farm trials is 20 years of experience, 15 mm-hmm. years of experience, right? Mm-hmm. Like people that know mm-hmm. way better than you how it is to grow the grass, to harvest the grass, to lift it, you know, how does it look when it's really under a particular infestation? What are the problems that are the most scared of, right? Like sometimes you go to the field and you're like, oh my God, that one doesn't look very good. It has some disease. And he's like, I'm not worried about that disease. I can spray for that. Don't worry about that. And you're like, oh, okay, that's good news then, okay. You know? I mean, they have so much wisdom on what are the traits that they care more about. You know, you get a different perspective. I always say you can have the best grass, right? Like the best soja grass that a golf course superintendent would absolutely love. Mm-hmm. Well, if that thing is not going to establish fast enough for the grower, if it's not going to lift well enough when he harvests it, it doesn't matter how great it is.
That's
He's
right.
never going to make it commercially.
That's right.
Right? And as a breeding program, you don't have the ability. I mean, at least not me. I know there's some huge programs out there. My program is still fairly small. I don't have a ton of land available to me. So, you know, like to me, growing a 25 square feet plot, it's like, oh my God, those are my big plots, right?
Yeah.
And when you go to a farm, you can grow a 10 by 20 plot,
yeah.
right? And in those large plots, that's when you really see the turf quality, mm-hmm. right? Like you get a full mm-hmm. view of how mm-hmm. good that grass is going to look. Mm-hmm. And then the other piece of on-farm trials is you're able to harvest sod, and the grower is able to tell you, and those are the things that only they can tell you, like I'm not a licensed sod harvester, right? Like they're able to tell you, well, that one lifts really well, or yeah, did you see how it cut? Right? Mm-hmm. Like that kind of information I don't have, mm-hmm. I get from them, and is incredibly useful as you make your decisions for commercialization.
Now, as you go through the process of your breeding and bringing it to market, as you've done it over the years, right? Like every other aspect of our discipline, it's been impacted by technology. And when I look mm-hmm. at digital agriculture initiatives, particularly at our university here at Cornell, we see some of the biggest advances in rapid phenotyping, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and using image analysis and YOLO. And I watched enough of it this past year at the crop science meetings. I'm feeling mm-hmm. almost that I understand a little bit of it. Do you think technology is going to have impacts on breeding, accelerating things, whether it's through large language models or machine learning with large data sets or rapid phenotyping of these plants? How do you see technology really impacting breeding moving forward, Susanna?
Well, I mean, like there's been incredible advances in genotyping, right? Mm-hmm. Now you can have the exact sequence of
yes,
a genotype.
Of
you
course.
Can see if it carries a particular mutation. So it has mm-hmm. these genes versus these other genes.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with phenotyping, where you can fly drones and you can calculate all these vegetation indexes, mm-hmm. you know, and get these like thousands of mm-hmm. data points.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess I'll be the grouch in the crowd. You know, I see the good and the bad. One of my graduate advisors used to say, you have to go to the field often enough to be able to recognize a lucky break when you see it.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And there's this other quote, you know, that breeding is a science, but it's also an art. You have to spend some time with your plants. You have to learn your crop.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, there's things that you'll see in the field that no data is going to tell you, right? There's a certain feel for what you do. And also, we talk about genetics and gene editing and marker disease selection and QTL mapping and all these different technologies, right? And ultimately, if you look at a lot of the cultivars that are there in the market, I mean, in turf is all, but I'm talking just in general, mm-hmm. right? The commodities, when you look at all the commodities, most of the advances that you see, I mean, the incredible advances in yield, for example, right? Like a lot of that just comes from conventional plant breeding, right? Mm-hmm. I think you have to take with a grain of salt, like how much of the new you want to incorporate. Mm-hmm. And you can never, never disregard how much of what we have accomplished in plant breeding in general and turf breeding specifically has been accomplished by, you know, people making crosses, walking fields, making selections, mm-hmm. you know, with a pen and a notepad, right?
Yes. But at the same time, right, we're training graduate students. You're obviously training graduate students. Mm-hmm. And so you have to expose them. They have to know those tools exist. Yes. And this isn't unlike what we tell golf course superintendents. It's like, listen, try to go get some useful data. Data you think is actionable. And then you still make the decision. It might not go any faster, but it might be a little bit more informed. And I'm thinking that, you know, as you train the next generation of plant breeders, they have to understand that maybe in a way that you and I didn't have to understand 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, Frank, I don't want to sound utterly negative. I mean, like, we actually do plenty of genomics work
sure
in the
do.
Program. I mean, those are all the theses the grad students do are on genomics.
Yes.
And you know, we're doing a ton of high-throughput phenotyping, looking at drones and images and all that stuff, right?
Right.
So we do plenty of that work. But I don't want the newer generations to discount the old stuff. I think there is a place, you cannot just fly a drone. I mean, this idea that you're just going to fly a drone, download the data, and you're going to make a selection of this is the best line, mm-hmm. is not very realistic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to choose, you need to make sure that you're using the tools right. And there's a lot of validation that goes into that, right? Like, it's not like I fly, you know, I take data for a year, and then the next year I'm already evaluating my entire program that way,
yeah.
right? There is really yeah. a step-by-step on how you're converting to using these tools, you know, figuring out what are the best tools to use, when do you want to use them, right? So it's not just like, okay, I grab it, use it, and it's done. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research that go into it, and you need to know when is the best time to use it.
It's got to be an exciting time to have the collegiality you have, right? You have a lot of
yes.
folks. You guys are, you know, roughly of the same genre as far as ages go. Programs are different sizes for sure.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if that isn't the way things happen faster, that
yes.
you expand those collaborations and even get more in the desert Southwest. Maybe the new USDA scientist down there might do some planting. I know that he's got a setup mm-hmm. going on down there in Arizona now.
Yeah, we've been talking about that. You know, I always say that I was really impressed when I joined the turfgrass industry about the turf and scientific community, about how welcoming it is.
Mm-hmm.
I get very emotional talking about that because in some of my previous communities, there was a lot of competition mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm working on this. I don't want anybody else to work on this. And I remember being an ex-peanut breeder working into my first C5 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh my God, how is this going to go, right? Like, I'm super anxious. I'm not that extroverted. Mm-hmm. It takes me a while to make connections. And I remember walking in and, you know, Kevin Kainworthy, I always tell this story, was the first person who extended his hand, and I was like, oh, you're the new turfgrass breeder at NC State. And he was so warm and so welcoming. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a wonderful community. I mean, I honestly say I have made some real friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have personal friends that are turf breeders that we just sometimes call each other to chit-chat about life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, walking into C5 is always a party. And I mean that. I
yes.
mean, it's just so nice. I mean, it's like, oh, my friends that I see once a year, but they're still my friends, right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
really wonderful. And it's those connections that allow you to, you know, like write the proposals and get
That's
the grants
right.
and ultimately work together. And in some cases, you know, you cannot write the grants because you want to work those for those people, you know, to have an yeah. excuse to work with yeah. those people because you like them so much.
Yeah. And I think you're right. And one of the things I think about as a scientific discipline that I think is great that someone like you comes into with the tobacco and peanut background.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we tend to get a little narrowly focused in mm-hmm. turf, and we don't always see maybe what other industries, commodities, disciplines are doing. And I think breeders are better at that than maybe agronomists are, right? You don't see agronomists from soybean coming in to be an extension specialist in turf. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right.
I worry sometimes that our discipline gets a little bit narrow, but I think breeders, you guys work on a lot of different crops in many
mm-hmm.
ways. And so listen, Thank you so much for taking the time to join me. What a joy to have this conversation. I hope it's been fun for you, too.
It has been a lot of fun, Frank. Good. I had heard a lot about how fun these are. They were not lying. This is very impressive. I'm honored to be invited. Really, this was so much fun.
I'm great to have you. Dr. Susanna Mila Lewis from NC State University. I'm Dr. Frank Rossi here at Cornell University. This is Frankly Speaking. Thank you for joining us. Big thanks to Dr. Susanna Mila Lewis. Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet family of podcasts, is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Frankly Speaking is in its 11th season, and we thank our major sponsors, Frostbray Technologies, Dryject Services, and The Plant Food Company, for the support that makes us possible. Take a minute and explore what they have to offer. Frankly Speaking is produced at Rep Studios in downtown Ithaca, New York, by Nate Richardson, with artwork and music by Nicole and Tucker Rossi, support from Peter McCormick, John Kiger, and John Reitman. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining me.